From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, James Baker looks back on his years as Secretary of State, 1989 to 92, years that saw the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Gulf War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the start of face-to-face peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians. Also today, Anatoly Dobrynin looks back on his nearly 25 years as the Soviet ambassador to the U.S., a period that covers most of the Cold War. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new historical novel Panama, and linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts on the N-word. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations says conditions are set for a Bosnian ceasefire. A UN spokeswoman says utilities in Sarajevo are restored, a key condition for the U.S. brokered truce. The ceasefire had been scheduled to begin just after midnight Sarajevo time, but it stalled when gas and electricity hadn't been restored. That situation improved today, prompting UN officials to declare the truce would begin shortly after midnight tonight. But the Bosnian government must still agree, and there's been no confirmation from officials. Construction crews are working to get cranes to the Amtrak derailment site in Arizona. A road needs to be upgraded for heavy equipment to reach the remote area. No railroad track repairs can be made until then. One person died in yesterday's crash, and 78 were hurt. President Clinton says the perpetrators will be caught and tried.
We believe it was a case of sabotage, and I am profoundly outraged by it. I want to make it clear that we will do everything we can with the federal government to catch whoever is responsible. I am determined that we will make sure that in the United States we will have the tools, the means we need to keep the American people safe.
Meanwhile, several agencies are investigating the derailment. The lead investigator for the National Transportation Safety Board says it's not clear when the FBI will allow the track to be cleared. Amtrak is rerouting its passenger trains. A note or notes were found outside the wreck. They refer to the federal standoffs at Waco and Ruby Ridge. One was signed Sons of Gestapo. The FBI has not commented. President Clinton has also welcomed Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo to the White House. UPI's Bill Small has this report.
Mr. Clinton praised Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo at the start of his two-day state visit, saying Mexico had embarked on a course of economic and political transformation. And in a South Lawn arrival ceremony, Mr. Clinton hailed the results of the U.S. bailout during Mexico's financial crisis.
Mexico's early repayment of $700 million serves proof that our actions were proper and that they will be rewarded. The Mexican economy has turned the corner and the markets have taken notice.
Mr. Clinton used the occasion to also send condolences to the victims and their families of yesterday's earthquake in western Mexico. Bill Small at the White House.
Cuban President Fidel Castro has applied for a U.S. visa to attend the 50th anniversary celebration of the United Nations in New York this month. The State Department says the visa is expected to be granted. The formal decision on the application is expected in the next few days. It would be Castro's third visit to the United States. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 3.5 points at 47.22. The Nasdaq is down 3. This is NPR. Taiwanese President Li Teng-hui said today that the chances of Taiwan reuniting with mainland China depends on the Chinese government's willingness to respect Taiwan's democratic system. Li was speaking at a Taiwanese National Day holiday celebration. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
In his speech today, Li called on China to drop its confrontational stance toward Taiwan, which included two sets of military exercises near the island this summer, and to be more responsive to what he called the aspirations for democracy of 1.2 billion Chinese people. Li's speech comes at a time of especially tense relations between Taiwan and China. The Chinese government was outraged by Li's private visit to the U.S. in June, seeing it as an attempt by Taiwan to take a step toward independence. China sees Taiwan as a renegade province and has threatened to invade if it ever breaks away. Taiwan also sees itself as part of a divided China, but has said it does not want to reunite until the mainland's standard of living and democratic rights catch up with Taiwan's. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Hong Kong.
A general strike in France is slowing down activity. More than 5 million public sector workers are off the job today to protest a proposed pay freeze announced by the government, which is trying to balance the budget. Train and airline workers are participating in the strike, as well as teachers, hospital workers, phone employees, and letter carriers. The action is supposed to last 24 hours, but union leaders suggest it could go on longer. The Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics has gone to American Robert Lucas of the University of Chicago. Lucas says his work has made governments more skeptical about how they are able to affect their economies. The Swedish Academy says Lucas has shown that people react so cautiously to government changes in monetary policy that the changes have little impact. Further, the Nobel Committee says Lucas's theories had great influence on how experts look at wages, supply, and demand. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the years my guest James Baker served as Secretary of State, 1989 to 92, the Berlin Wall fell, the Soviet Union collapsed, we fought the Gulf War, and the Israelis and Palestinians began face-to-face talks. Baker has written a memoir about his tenure as Secretary of State called The Politics of Diplomacy. Baker was appointed by President Bush. The two men were old friends. Baker first entered politics to help Bush in his losing Senate campaign in 1970. Baker went on to work in Ronald Reagan's 1980 presidential campaign and then served as Reagan's White House Chief of Staff and Treasury Secretary. He ran George Bush's 1988 presidential campaign and left his position as Secretary of State to take over Bush's re-election campaign in 92. One of Baker's greatest accomplishments was in helping to begin talks between Israelis, Palestinians, and Arabs. But in his memoir, Baker says he wanted to avoid the Middle East peace process. He saw it as a pitfall to be avoided rather than an opportunity to be exploited. I asked him what initially discouraged him about getting involved.
Well, I had watched other secretaries of state become involved, and in almost every instance, they got burned and got burned badly. And then before I entered into the job, I went around and sat down with every living ex-president of the United States and almost every living ex-secretary of state to get their advice on the job. And many of them said, avoid the Middle East if you can, that most secretaries of state get sucked into that. You really can't do much unless the parties themselves are willing to take the necessary steps to make peace. And so I entered my tour of duty as Secretary of State with that in mind.
You felt betrayed by Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Why?
Well, I felt betrayed because we worked very, very hard to construct a Palestinian delegation Prime Minister Shamir's rules and his formula. And the government of Israel, he refused to go along with one Palestinian representative who was a dual addressee, that is, someone who lived in the West Bank but had an apartment in Jerusalem. He refused to go along with that person on the Palestinian delegation because he had an apartment in Jerusalem didn't vote for moving forward, and the government fell. And I thought that was an extraordinarily technical issue on which to subvert a lot of efforts that we'd made toward getting a peace process started.
Why did you see the end of the Gulf War as an opportunity for Middle East peace talks?
Well, because the Cold War clearly was over. The Arab rejectionist states no longer had a patron in the Soviet Union that would be willing to keep them armed and send them armaments. We Americans had defeated Arab rejectionism in the Gulf by defeating Iraq. We had great credibility with the Arab states, with Saudi Arabia and with Egypt and with Jordan and other states, and we felt we could get them to change their long-standing policy of refusing to speak to Israel and get them to come to the table with Israel, and indeed we were able to do that.
So how did you proceed differently after the war than you had before the war?
After the war, we put in process a double track. Before the war, we were trying to set up a dialogue between Israelis and Palestinians from within the territories. After the war, We worked on a dialogue between Israel, Palestinians from within the territories, and Israel's Arab neighbor states. We also had not only bilateral negotiations like that, we also had multilateral negotiations to take up, to discuss issues such as economic issues and cultural issues and so forth, and in multilateral discussions, which involved a lot more countries in the region, not just Israel's neighbors, involved countries like Saudi Arabia and so forth.
When you were trying to get Israelis and Palestinians to agree to sit down at the table and talk, what were the most compelling arguments you made to each side?
Well, you don't have a lot of leverage. As I point out in the book, the main leverage you have is that they all want America to be involved and to be engaged. That's one of the reasons some of these prior former secretaries of state and former presidents said, don't touch it, because they'll suck you in, and then they won't make the necessary moves required to make progress. And we would frequently say, well, if you're not willing to do this, then we'd have to say that the talks broke down because you were unwilling to do this, and that would generally keep things moving.
Is there an element of therapy, or at least like psyching everybody out, when you're doing this kind of diplomacy?
Well, I don't know that it's psyching everybody out. I mean, I think they all know that they want to avoid the political opprobrium of being blamed for the collapse of a peace effort. Nobody wants to have that tag put on them. And they do want to keep us engaged, both the Israelis and the Arabs. And so I used those two pieces of bits of leverage as best I could.
Let's talk about the Gulf War. The Iran-Iraq War ended toward the end of the Reagan administration. And then President Bush ordered a strategic review on Iraq shortly after he was elected. And, you know, one of the big questions about our so-called tilt toward Iraq in the early days of the Bush administration was that, you know, you apparently were warned by the CIA that Iraq was advancing its nuclear missile programs and developing chemical and biological weapons. So how much did you take that into account when strengthening our relations with Iraq?
The thinking was that at the end of the Iran-Iraq war, Iraq was pretty much a worn-out country, that they had to rebuild, that they had to consolidate. They'd fought a long and exhausting war. It made good sense for us, in my view, to try and see if we could establish reasonably good relations with them and moderate their behavior. We were unable to do that with a policy of engagement. I say in the book that I think it's too bad we didn't have Iraq higher up on our radar screen than we did. The top policymakers, President Bush, myself, and perhaps others, were really not paying much attention to Iraq because we were involved with the collapse of communism, with German reunification, issues like that that were of far broader significance to the United States. And so it's conceivable that we might have been able to deter Saddam from invading Kuwait if we'd given more forceful warnings to him. I rather doubt it, and I write that in the book. I really think the only thing that would have dissuaded him from invading Kuwait would have been a movement of U.S. forces to the region, something that that our Congress would have objected to at the time and that our Arab allies in the region would really not have welcomed. They frankly thought we were going to overreact to Saddam's threats and provoke him into action. Nevertheless, we didn't deter him, and ironically enough, and I spend a little time on this in the book, ironically enough, had we deterred his invasion of Kuwait, instead of going in there and reversing it in the way that we did, we might today be faced with a far more dangerous situation in the Persian Gulf. We might be faced with an Iraq and a Saddam Hussein with his arms around significant biological and chemical weapons capability and a nuclear weapon. That's not the case. We now have him. He's still there, unfortunately, but he's in a very tight cage.
Well, weren't we increasing Iraq's line of credit after we knew that they were escalating their biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons programs?
No, that's not correct. We did not do that after we had concrete evidence that they were escalating their weapons of mass destruction efforts. We did increase their grain credits to Iraq as a part of our policy to moderate their behavior, but we pretty much reevaluated that policy and moved away from it and began to condition all of the things we were doing for Iraq, I think about late March or April of 1990. The invasion of Kuwait, of course, was in August of 1990.
James Baker is my guest, and he's written a memoir about his years as Secretary of State in the Bush administration. The memoir is called The Politics of Diplomacy. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Baker, he's written a memoir about his years as Secretary of State, 1989 to 92. It's called The Politics of Diplomacy. When you give a deadline to a dictator on the verge of a war, is that a frightening thing for you? I mean, because then it means if they don't meet the deadline, then you've actually got to start bombing. Yeah.
You've got to go. Well,
I mean, it's kind of, you've got to follow through once you're given a deadline, right?
That's correct. Our view was that the only thing that this man understood was force. He'd built his regime on force. He understands strength. I remember a meeting with Shevardnadze when he said, now, if you set this deadline, we're willing to go along with you, but if you set this deadline, he said, you know, you got to go forward if he doesn't meet it. And I said, we know that full well. And he said, well, have you given consideration to the consequences? Don't believe in all the rosy scenarios that your military will give you. They gave us a lot of rosy scenarios in Afghanistan, and it didn't work. I said, Edward, I want you to listen to a briefing from a general that's traveling with me from our Joint Chiefs of Staff. And we gave the Soviet foreign minister a detailed briefing of what we planned to do and how we were going to do it to kick Iraq out of Kuwait. Iraq, a Soviet client state. This was unprecedented, something we wouldn't even considered having done a year before. But at the end of that briefing, Shevardnadze smiled and he said, I can see you've thought this through.
At what point did you realize that war was going to be inevitable?
Well, I knew after the meeting with Tariq Aziz in Geneva on January the 9th that we were going to war, because the deadline was very real in our view. And it was quite apparent after 7 hours of meeting with him in Geneva that he had no flexibility whatsoever from Saddam. In fact, Saddam sent his brother-in-law to sit right next to him there to make sure he didn't depart from his brief. I knew at that time that we were headed toward war 7 days later. And one of the most emotional moments, frankly, if I might add it here, in my entire service as Secretary of State was when I went from that meeting and addressed some of our fighter pilots and crews at an air base in Taif, Saudi Arabia. The crew, the pilots who would be in the first wave of attacks on Baghdad when the air war was to begin just 7 days later, that was quite an emotional moment.
You threatened Saddam Hussein about what would happen if he used chemical or biological weapons. What did you tell him?
What I told Tariq Aziz in that meeting on January the 9th was that my exact words were, if you use weapons of mass destruction against our forces, the American people will demand vengeance, and we have the means to exact it. I said, this is not a threat. It is a promise. We've just learned now in the last 3 or 4 weeks from UN inspectors that they took that warning to heart. The Iraqis now tell the UN inspectors that's the reason they didn't use that rather significant array of chemical and biological weapons that they had developed.
But in the book, it makes it seem like you were bluffing, because the implication there was that you'd be willing to use tactical nuclear weapons if Iraq used biological or chemical weapons.
I wanted him to think that. As I write in the book, it was a calculated ambiguity. But I can't sit here today and tell you that if Iraq had used biological weapons against our forces, I cannot tell you that the president would not have re-examined his decision not to use tactical nuclear weapons, battlefield nuclear weapons. If we were subjected to attack by biological weapons from an outlaw state like Iraq, I'm not at all sure that the president would not have reconsidered his original decision not to use nuclear weapons.
Where were you the opening night of the war when you were actually watching
I was in my office on
CNN?
Yeah, I was in my office watching on CNN, watching John Holloman and Bernie Shaw reporting from Baghdad, sitting there with some of my staff, and they were saying, "Well, nothing's happening here," and frankly, it looked to me like we were a few minutes late. And I began to say to my staff, "It looks like something may have happened. It should have started by now." And with that, they were reporting from underneath their desks because they said the sky lit up, and the bombs began falling.
How did it feel to know that you were, in part, one of the architects of the war, you were watching play out on TV?
Yeah, it was a very strange feeling. Something I suppose I'll never experience again in my life. But I felt that we'd done everything we could to eject Iraq peacefully. We'd utilized political, diplomatic, and economic measures, and this was the only thing, in my view, that was going to get the job done. And I think we all felt that we would be able to do it and do it well.
James Baker is my guest. He's written a memoir about his years as Secretary of State in the Bush administration. It's called The Politics of Diplomacy. Well, I have a very important diplomacy question to ask you. How comfortable is the jet that you traveled on when you're doing shuttle diplomacy?
Well, I had a bed on it, and it's the only thing that kept the jet lag from just killing me. But it was a 1959 or 1957 707. Actually, it used to be Air Force One at one time. But it served me well, and I think served the country well. But it was an old airplane, and sometimes in turbulent weather, you'd hear a lot of creaking and groaning. But I never felt safer than when I flew 710,000 miles in 3.5 years, courtesy of the U.S. Air Force. I always felt very, very safe with those Air Force pilots up there.
In all honesty, I really don't understand how a Secretary of State can deal with all this jet lag and have the kind of presence of mind that you need when you're, doing these high-level negotiations.
People asked me that the other day. I said I took Halcyon. They laughed.
You took Halcyon?
They said, how did you deal with it? I said, well, I took Halcyon and I had a good bed on my airplane. But I did take Halcyon, and I never had any adverse side effects from it or anything. But it helped me get some rest when the time zones had me all screwed up. But the main way I did it was by taking full advantage of that bed that was on my airplane and sleeping a lot between legs.
Well, James Baker, I want to thank you very much for talking with
us. Thanks, Terry. I really enjoyed talking with you.
James Baker's new memoir about his years as Secretary of State is called The Politics of Diplomacy. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that Eric Zencey's new suspense novel, Panama, may give some readers a delicious sense of déjà vu all over again.
There's a fear that keeps lots of writers at their desks long after inspiration has faded. It's the fear that somewhere out there, at another desk, another writer is working on a similar book, and it's going to be published first. That writer's nightmare came true for first-time novelist Eric Zencey. At work on his eerie historical thriller, Panama, for the past 9 years, Zencey was trumped by Caleb Carr, whose own eerie historical thriller, The Alienist, became a bestseller last year. Both novels reanimate prominent Americans as their detectives, Teddy Roosevelt in The Alienist, Henry Adams in Panama. Moreover, both books take place in turn-of-the-century cities, and they both make use of newly invented forensic techniques like fingerprinting. So which is the better book? Well, I think it boils down to whether you prefer the company of Teddy Roosevelt or Henry Adams, because these two novels take their coloration from their detective heroes. The Alienist, like the old Rough Rider himself, is an edgy, physical story. In fact, the blood and gore of its opening scene was too much for one person I recommended it to. Panama is steeped in political intrigue and an overwhelming sense of doom, as befits the pessimistic social critic and historian Adams. Personally, I can't decide. Teddy's tale is weirdly wired, while Adams' story is quietly and intellectually perverse. Panama finds Henry Adams in Paris in 1892, in the midst of the world tour he actually took to try to escape the memory of his wife Clover's suicide 7 years before. While visiting Mount St. Michel, Adams meets a young woman named Miriam, who promises to free him from what he calls his posthumous life as a widower. But Miriam soon disappears, as Adams, with the help of his friend, future Secretary of State John Hay, desperately tries to find Miriam, he's led deeper and deeper into the political labyrinth known as the Panama Affair. Zensi, who's a history professor as well as a novelist, deftly details the intricacies of the Panama Affair without bringing his suspense story to a yawning halt. Suffice it to say here that the scandal involved the bribing of French legislators by officials of the failed Panama Canal Company. Like Henry Adams himself, whose classic histories read more like novels than textbooks, Zensi pulls out all the fictional stops to create a brooding vision of fin de siècle Paris. We visit the city morgue in the shadow of Notre Dame and a primitive kind of communication center where the severed fingers of a corpse are delivered to Adams by pneumatic tube. But for Adams, who was an impassioned foe of modernity, even greater horrors lurk in Parisian shop windows. Looking at the displays of new household gadgets, he comments, "The very furniture of life was changing. Wheels and levers, blades and whirligigs, all of them cumulatively were sinister, the more so for being new and shiny." Because he was no fan of popular culture, I have a suspicion that Henry Adams wouldn't be too tickled at his reincarnation here as a detective. Too bad. I rather prefer the wisdom of that stiletto-edged modernist, Bertolt Brecht, who observed that we should always prefer the bad new days to the good old ones. Besides, Eric Zensi shows these days are good ones indeed for dazzling works of literary alchemy like Panama.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Panama, a new novel by Eric Zensi. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a look at the Cold War years through the eyes of Anatoly Dobrynin, the former Soviet ambassador to the U.S. He was the link between Moscow and Washington from Presidents Kennedy to Reagan. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the N-word. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During most of the Cold War, from 1962 to 86, my guest Anatoly Dobrynin was the Soviet ambassador to the U.S. From the Cuban Missile Crisis to the beginning of Perestroika, he was the primary link between Washington and Moscow. He's written a new memoir about those years called In Confidence. A review in the Sunday New York Times described the memoir as surely the most revealing account of the Cold War to come out of the Soviet Union. Now Dobrynin lives in Moscow and serves as a consultant to the Foreign Ministry of the Russian Federation. Dobrynin says that in Washington he was granted access that others found astonishing for the ambassador of the Soviet Union, and his own government in Moscow gave him unprecedented latitude. But it was, after all, the spy versus spy era, so I asked him if his home or his embassy office was bugged during his years in Washington.
Offices, I hope not. But home, I guess it was.
Did you go around looking for microphones?
Not me. I have many other things to do. Well, let me put it this way, frankly. When it was a new building, we have now a new building in Washington, D.C., when it was over, we find about $200 in our new embassy building. Well, when you build there in Moscow, your engineers find something, bucks too. So it was a mutual intelligence war.
Now, you write in your memoir that your office in Washington, D.C. had a double layer of walls. And in between those walls, there was a magnetic force.
Yeah. This was a way of shield defense against bugging. I don't know how effective it was, but at least our engineers believe this is effective enough to shield ambassador in his small office against listening devices from outside.
Now, did you ever worry that the Soviets were bugging you? That your own
Soviets?
Yeah, that your own people were.
Oh no,
were bugging
no,
you.
No, no, never.
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 Okay.
Why should they?
Well, just to check up on you, make sure that.
Well, I think they couldn't check up on me because I was so free-going ambassador to many people where they couldn't check really anything. When I was going, I was my predecessor. Unfortunately, most of them were sitting in the embassy. They didn't want to go anywhere. It was a heritage from Stalin, which really was just to stay and to speak as minimum as possible with the foreigners. Well, I was in a little bit a new breed of Soviet diplomats. I was much more free-going, and I discussed. So I didn't have any idea that they could bug me. Why? There is no need, because if they wanted, they could learn from me.
So tell me more about how you saw your style as a new breed of Soviet ambassador.
Well, I was, first of all, when I met with the American officials, I used to go alone. During the Stalin period, it was must you have somebody with you just to be sure that the conversation was within the certain kind of limits, so to speak. But when I went there and I decided that in order to have a confidential talk, so to build this confidence, at least to the minimal extent, I need to talk with the American officials, if possible, tete-a-tete. Then it give you a chance to speak more freely. Then it was just everything is put on in writing or through the interpreter or note taker. But if you just sit and relax and then we can know each other for many months, you take it at ease when you discuss even very official documents. Much more business-like and sometimes even friendly atmosphere.
There has often been a fear in the United States that the Soviets were trying to interfere in American politics, trying to exert some control over American politics.
How?
You write about one instance. You write
how?
About one instance in which the Soviet leadership told you to offer money to Hubert Humphrey for his presidential campaign.
Well, they put it assistance, not money as such. But including financial assistance, too.
What other kind of assistance?
Assistance, including financial assistance, if you like. But it was the only one stupid thing they make it. Never before or after, they never repeat it. I was against from the very beginning.
So
we shouldn't do it.
So the Kremlin wanted Humphrey to win the election over Nixon because Nixon was so staunchly anti-communist.
Yes, that's true.
So who told you to offer him assistance?
Well, I get a telegram from Moscow. It's a decision of Politburo. You have to go and do this one. And I objected. So they sent me, it was Gromyka who sent the telegram. He sent me second telegram that said, this is a decision of Politburo, so please speak with in one way or another with Humphrey. Maybe he needs some help, which you could give him in order to be elected. So I again said that it's a very dangerous thing to do, and it will not help at all. But they say you should do it. Well, I spoke, I knew Humphrey quite well for many years, and he understood from the first word. So he said, thank you very much for the good attention from Moscow. I don't need anything.
So tell me how you made this offer to Hubert Humphrey in such a way that he knew that your heart wasn't in it, but it was your job to offer it.
Now I couldn't really repeat because I don't recall what happened in word by word. My heart was definitely not in it, and he understood quite well.
Did you think for a moment he'd say yes?
No. 100% no.
The Politburo wanted you to support Humphrey so that Humphrey would win over Nixon. Of course, Nixon won that election. And what surprised me was in the re-election where Nixon and McGovern were running, the Soviet Union, your leadership wanted Nixon to win over McGovern. Why?
Because a relationship which exists between Nixon administration and my government was good. So they decided why to change the horses, so to speak, if possible, to continue to work with the man, with the president, with whom we have already made some good agreements. Take SALT I. It was a really breakthrough in arms controls. Never was done before in our relationship. So a relationship with developing and business-like, so atmosphere, and we think it's much better to have the president we already know for 4 years than to change and completely have another unknown man.
It was ironic to me. You seem to have a better relationship with the leaders, the American leaders who supported the Cold War, as opposed to some of the more liberal American political leaders who were more receptive to forging a better relationship with the Soviet Union.
Well, I'm answering a very simple answer. You are really saying as if you are a theoretician.
As if I'm a theoretician?
Yes, you are speaking right now like a theoretician, but not a practical man or practical woman in a diplomacy. We look at them, what kind of practical results we have with the president in our treaties, agreements. So it's not what they're saying publicly or not publicly or background. Background, Nixon have a very bad background from our point of view, from point of view of Soviet-American relations. But in a practical diplomacy, in practical activity as a president during the first 4 years, we find that he was constructive enough to find agreements, sign some agreements. So it was all right with us. We don't really care specifically whether he has a label of anti-communist or not. We look about it in a practical way.
Will you talk about President Reagan, for instance, as using very harsh words publicly about the Soviet Union, but behind the scenes being much more conciliatory?
But really, and this is conciliatory, it's true. But during the first...
Maybe I should say friendly rather than conciliatory.
Well, friendly, we might put it really friendly. But the question is, during the first presidency, we do not have any constructive government-to-government relation during this during the Reagan period.
During Reagan's first term?
Yes.
No good relations?
Yes, no. We don't have any practical relationship at all.
Mm-hmm.
But from the second presidency, we have a really good practical relations, which we're improving each month a little better. We have a 3 major agreement signed with him on arms control. And there was 4 meetings on a top level. He has more than any other president of the United States, top level with our government leaders. So it changed. So if it changed, we don't hold him because on the first term he was not good one. So he became better constructive and we felt it as a way to develop. So on the second term, it was quite all right.
Yes, you write in your memoir that a great paradox of President Reagan was that he first heightened the Cold War, then helped to cool it off.
Yes, true. This is his philosophy. My impression was really, when he came to power, he thought that United States is not strong enough to and for him, the president, to negotiate from the position of strength. So he spent 4 years, first 4 years, really to build up arms forces of the United States. He spent twice as much as on a military budget, etc. But after 4 years, he felt he's strong enough and he now could speak and negotiate from the position of strength to find more peaceful relationship between our two countries.
Who was the American president you worked with that you found most difficult to deal with?
Well, it was difficult with Reagan on a first presidency. On a second, it was easy to deal with him. Well, as for the others, I think it depends on the situation. For instance, with Carter, he was with many with the good intentions. He really wanted to have, but the tragedy was and is that during his period, we have a very better relationship between two countries. But his intention was always good.
Who was the Soviet president that was best and worst to deal with?
But there was very few of them, really, because it was at that time it was Khrushchev, then there was Brezhnev, there was Andropov, and there was Chernenko, and then it was Gorbachev. Well, I may put it, if you like, very briefly. Khrushchev, he was very emotional fellow. He really couldn't control his emotions, as sometimes he doing. In general, I think he opened, in a way, a door to negotiation with the United States, but it was a very bumpy road in dealing with them. And Brezhnev, he was more relaxed, so to speak, but he was a man who worked together with other Politburo, because Khrushchev sometimes overruled Politburo and make his own decision, emotional decision. So it was rather a mixture, combination of collective leadership and his own. With Brezhnev, it was always collective leadership. He never went against the majority of Politburo. And, well, Chernenko was nothing really. It was completely zero in our policy history. Andropov was a good one. He probably the most knowledgeable president we have. Not president, he was the secretary general. But he died rather soon.
My guest is Anatoly Dobrynin. He was Soviet ambassador to the U.S. from 1962 to 86. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anatoly Dobrynin, the former Soviet ambassador to the U.S., he's written a new memoir called In Confidence. Did you ever feel like any of the American or Soviet presidents that you worked with were willing to use nuclear weapons?
No. Answer is 100% no, from both sides. Because I spent too many years in your country, and I know how that developed, so I didn't really believe that you're going to attack us suddenly with the nuclear weapons. As for our, I knew too perfectly well, because one thing, when I, first thing which was given instruction by, when I was appointed as ambassador, I was the youngest ambassador in the United States from our diplomatic service, Khrushchev invited me to the Kremlin, and he said, Ambassador, your number one task is avoid by any cost any war, especially nuclear war, with the United States. This is number one task you always have to keep in mind. And all others, beginning our president or the chiefs, they always repeat me the same. So I knew that there was no any plans for immediate attack, etc. I knew from there, and I was sure about you. But it's not what the case in our own government. Let me put it this way. During the Reagan period, especially during the first period, there were some suspicions, rather strong suspicions in my country, and not in country too, but within the Politburo, that he might be to do something. I remember Andropov once told me directly, you could expect everything from Reagan. So be careful and watch very carefully about him.
Let me ask you what might strike you as an unusual question.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. I know when I was a girl growing up, I used to have nuclear war nightmares all the time, right? And there were nuclear war horror movies and nuclear war political movies, and the whole country was obsessed with nuclear bombs.
Yeah.
Did you ever have nuclear war nightmares?
Me?
Yes.
Well, not at all.
Never?
Never. Well, you see, if you compare to nations during that period you're just referring to, exactly, you gave already explanation. In your country, you have a mass media, movies and press, etc. When you created on a certain period of your history, a really mass madness about the nuclear things. In my country, we don't have this. We were not that influenced by mass media about the horrors of the nuclear war as you. That's why you have much more nightmares than we have it, because we were not influenced to the extent you were influenced during that time.
So did you ever feel closer to the United States than to the Soviet Union during that period of 3 decades when you lived in Washington?
But it's a philosophical question. It depends what do you mean closer. In what sense closer? I am Russian, so I'm Russian, but closer, well, I like many things in the United States.
Well, look, what things did you like better about the United States?
No, in general, the way of living, of freedom of expression, this kind, you could get all this style of life, really, not that restricted, not disciplinized. It's another kind of things you could much more free to discuss, to write about this. There are many really still style of life, which you may like or may not like it. I like it.
Are you sorry that the Soviet Union collapsed?
Yes, I am.
Why?
Because I, one who believes it was not inevitable for the Soviet Union to collapse. Second, it was really our people, as look at now, they lived now worse than they lived before, on a social side, I mean, on a well-being, on a material being. They are now going through the very difficult life. Great majority of my population, as of now, 80% live below the standard of living, poverty. Well, it was not really paradise during the Soviet period, I should say, but it was slow from year to year going on, build up improvement. We have, if you take a social system, all education was free. Now, many kids are running around the streets. They couldn't pay because their parents couldn't pay this. And we really pick up many fishes, not you, but the fishes from the capitalism, or rather of a free market system.
You say that you wanted to write your memoirs to serve as a warning against any recurrence of the mistakes of this century. Give us an example of a mistake that you think can be averted now.
Well, it's question, it's not a worry. The whole history of our relationship, it's really missed opportunities, a lot of them. Well, major mistake was what we were doing. We were fighting each other on all the in all areas during this Cold War period. We'll just take it, for instance, an example. Kennedy period, when you have 3,000 warheads, nuclear warheads, we have 300. Afterwards, we were so angry with each other. It was the Cold War, all the president, my secretary general. We built 35,000 build up. And now we come to the situation when we, after series of agreement or treaties with you, we come to the situation, to the last agreement which was signed between between your president Clinton and Yeltsin. It's really practically the same figures which were during the Kennedy-Khrushchev period. So why we spent 30 years fighting each other, spending billions and billions of dollars in order to create a new destruction, arms for destruction, nuclear things? Missiles, cruise missiles, MRF, and then now we agree it's nonsense. We agree that MRF should be destroyed. We agree that Euro missiles, medium range, should be destroyed under the Treaty of 87. They're destroyed. We agree that intercontinental strategic missiles should be destroyed. We agree already for 50% destruction, and now our two president, last president, they agree to bring them to the 30%. So you see, now we come into the situation when really we are, when we started the whole process. So is it not stupidity from both sides? What you have done, spending so many energy and really doing not good for your own country or for my own country? This is, I think, major mistake because of misconception.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Anatoly Dobrynin is the former Soviet ambassador to the U.S. His new memoir is called In Confidence. This is Fresh Air. The O.J. Simpson trial has left most Americans thinking about justice and race in America. It left our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, thinking about race and language.
Just after the O.J. verdict was announced, I was talking with a Stanford colleague, a Caribbean-born African-American. He was telling me about an image he'd seen on TV the night before, a spray-painted graffiti in L.A. that said, "The nigger did it." He said, "You know, I've been living in this country for 30 years, and I swear I've never seen or heard that word used in public so much as in the past few months." As I thought about it, 30 years seemed just about right. I recall being struck when I listened to the early episodes of Henry Hampton's Eyes on the Prize on PBS a couple of years ago at how unself-conscious a lot of white people seemed to be about using the word nigger in televised interviews back in the 50s and early 60s. It was only in the following years that this sort of language came to seem a little crude, particularly among middle-class suburban whites. They had already put the beltways between themselves and inner-city blacks, and now they wanted to put a little linguistic distance between themselves and the rednecks in Mayberry RFD. And politicians rapidly learned that they could just talk about welfare queens, quotas, or the element. I don't know that any of it made for a kinder, gentler nation, but it made for a slightly subtler one. But now the word seems to be all over the place again. Of course, I suppose that's partly just the Simpson trial. And it's true that there are a lot of words we never heard used in public so much as in the past few months. Bronco, for example. But the trial isn't the whole of it. There was a telling example on the Larry King show a couple of weeks ago. Robert Novak was the guest host, and Jesse Helms was the guest, and somebody called in from Alabama and said, "Mr. Helms, I know this might not be politically correct to say these days, but I just think that you should get a Nobel Peace Prize for everything you've done to help keep down the niggers." The two men laughed nervously, and then Novak said, "That was the bad word. That was politically incorrect. We don't really condone that language, do we?" Somehow, neither of them got around to saying anything about the content of the caller's remarks, like suggesting that it wasn't the sort of thing they ought to award the Nobel Peace Prize for. And in fact, neither of them disagreed with the caller's characterization of the word as politically incorrect. That phrase has undergone an interesting metamorphosis in the last few years. The movement against political correctness may have begun as a reaction to some overzealous academics, but it rapidly spread to a lot of people who wouldn't know a multiculturalist from a generic pronoun. If you took the anti-PC rhetoric at face value, it would make a strange picture, 100 million or so Americans all joined in the great solidarity of unfashionable individualism. But of course, a lot of it is just a convenient excuse for throwing all that hard-won hypocrisy over the side. Whenever you hear somebody start a sentence with, "This may not be the PC thing to say," the way that caller did, it's even odds you're in for some little spot of offensiveness that would have had people walking out of the room a couple of years ago. I mean, back before we learned that every time somebody utters a racial slur, they're striking a blow on behalf of our basic constitutional freedoms. Now, it's true that most middle-class whites are uncomfortable when they hear the word nigger used on the Larry King show or on tapes played in open court. Still, you wonder whether Mark Furman's main problem was that he came off as a racist or that he came off as a redneck racist. Certainly, there are a lot of whites who tend to think of these words the way they think of ordinary profanities. There was a suggestion of this in the coy way the press and the witnesses kept referring to the epithet in question as the N-word. That's the formula we always use for the words we teach our children not to say in polite conversation, and which, of course, they learn to take a naughty pleasure in saying in private. It's a repression that's been simmering for a long time, and you have the feeling that all of a sudden the cork has popped. The verdict is in, and the gloves are off.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center and Stanford University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Updike and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of The Practical Guide to Practically Everything, a one-volume personal library by Peter Bernstein and Christopher Ma. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Kazuo Ishiguro, author of the novel The Remains of the Day. He has a new novel called The Unconsoled. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.